Unite the Seven! Six! Oh wait, Superman's dead, so five? In honor of Justice League, what's the best movie finished by another director?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with The Outlaw Josie Wales, where Clint Eastwood replaced the director and inspired a DGA rule called the Eastwood Rule that made it so you can't do that anymore, but it's a pretty great Western.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with a fabulous animated film called Ratatouille, directed by Brad Bird, but in the beginning, directed by Jan Pinkava, the director of Gerald's Game. Is it called Gerald's Game, or is that the Stephen
Jerry's
King?
Game.
Gerald's Game is the Stephen
Gerald's
King.
Game is the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very different.
Chainer up in the bed thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Not that.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and there's a soft spot in my heart for the 13th Warrior, finished by Michael Crichton himself, and it's a wonderful Viking mess.
Hey, it's me, Dave, without a seven, and I... I'm going to keep things in the spirit of more recent movies and go with Moneyball, where Steven Spielberg was not involved at all, but Steven Soderbergh was fired and was replaced by fucking Foxcatcher Bro, whatever the hell his name is, Bennett Miller. And one of the only times where I think it was to the good of the film that Steven Soderbergh would be replaced by the guy who made Foxcatcher. That is not a Steven Soderbergh movie. And Bennett Miller... Pun intended, wait for it, knocked it out of the park.
Because it was about baseball and math.
I heard it was about baseball.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here, this is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 190 and it's Wednesday, November 14th. And on this day in 1976, Network premiered in both New York and Los Angeles. And lucky for us, news media all got really good after that.
Mm-hmm. That was the end of all of our problems.
Yeah. And no one is ever mad at hell and not taking anymore. And you would certainly not get your own TV show for screaming every night.
Well, we hope we do, because that's kind of what we do around here.
That's true. Just lots of screaming. Before we get started, I hear we have some reviews.
Oh, do we ever? Do we ever, Katie?
All the Irish accents.
I couldn't tell if anyone could hear that. It snuck through there. do we ever? I was watching Lady Bird, and I can't do this on command, but there is definitely one line in Lady Bird, one very particular line where Saoirse Ronan, who otherwise gives the best performance of the year, sneaks in a little bit of her Irish accent.
What line?
That would be telling.
Is it the one where she goes,
for yourself?
Can you turn up for Dave Matthews?
Is it? It goes, play Crash into me. Yeah. And oh
I got a flip phone. It's my first.
We're verging under Ringo, guys.
We've offended a lot of people. We can be sure of that.
Don't do accents.
Got to see Lady Bird. Yeah, no.
It also kind of turns into Mark Wahlberg after a while. Like, it does. Chicken, how you doing? Say hi to your mom for me.
See, Patriots Day. David saw Daddy's Home 2 on Thursday. It's terrible. John Lithgow does an improv scene.
So we have reviews not from our UK store where we will never get any more again.
Oh, no.
This.
We've been banned. We first have a review, I think, that was foretold last week, promised, threatened to be read. T. Dobbles. My favorite movie podcast, they say. I've been listening to this podcast for probably over 2 years and have been meaning to leave a review for quite some time, in parentheses, sorry, guys. We'll see if the apology is accepted. By the end of this review, I'm on the fence. Each week, I look forward to listening to the new episode, Dave Seven, Katie, Matt, and David, and occasional guests create interesting conversations each and every week, even when their discussions detour towards other significant personal or even political topics. Their perspectives create a satisfying balance as their coverage of a wide variety of genres and types of film. I find myself disagreeing with each of the hosts at one time or another, and David 70% of the time. I appreciate being able to hear divergent ideas from people who clearly care both for films and for each other, but now my parenthetical, we seldom talk about Divergent. We should address that. My one complaint is that I really missed the game Thought Bubble. It was the best comic related podcast, and I'm not into Game of Thrones, so I gave up on Storm of Spoilers. Diss. Also, my favorite episode was the one with discussion on whether Blu-rays matter in light of the digital media and streaming, as I skipped from DVDs to digital copies. Anyway, keep up the great work. T. Dabbles, I do forgive you, and I think I can forgive you on behalf of everyone else here. Also, this review is helpful because it reminded me something that I occasionally forget, which is that these reviews are actually, at least in spirit, intended for people who have not listened to the show to tell them what the show is and if they should listen to it. Whereas I think at this point, I just think of them as personal letters to us and people who know that I will just read anything that is written. So
they're just your performance reviews.
Yeah, exactly.
From our bosses who are our listeners.
Exactly. This is true. You are the shareholders in our show, and we have to take in all of your feedback. Thank you. Darby Act says, amazing, great film podcast. I left a review on iTunes about a year ago, and it wasn't read on the podcast. So in hopes of making the cut this time around, I'm re-reviewing this amazing podcast. The four critics on the show are thoughtful, smart, and always have a new way of looking into movies and their best and worst traits. David E. is one of my favorite critics, and I love to hear his never-ending love for Carol. Katie is the reason I found the show because of her great work on Little Gold Men. And this show, Dave Seven, is a great voice for the nerds of the world. And Patches is always on point with his thoughts and opinions. The hosts make the show. While I have you here, I'm taking advantage of asking your thoughts on Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. I love this film and felt that it was a very heartfelt and honest look at a subject matter that usually goes under the radar, but I've heard no one talking about it. Thoughts, Darby Act, before I turn this over to Katie, who I think has seen this movie.
No, I haven't.
Before I turn this over to Dave, who I think has seen this movie, you are right in that nobody's talking about it because nobody saw it because it had one of the worst opening weekends of a film opening on 1,000 screens ever. And I think that has nothing to do with the quality of the movie or the subject matter, which should have been with all the Wonder Woman hysteria.
I mean, I don't even recall being invited
thoroughly
to see
mismanaged.
The movie.
And it should have been platform released rather than just dumped in 1,000 screenings in like a mini wide release. It was botched from start to finish. One day there will be an oral history about it that 18 people will read and they'll find it very enlightening.
You might write it.
David, that's me. Dave, what do you think?
I actually haven't seen it, but what I can is I could point it to two very intelligent people who have a conversation about it on the Storm of Spoilers podcast. The previous reviewer mentioned the thought bubble wasn't around anymore and he gave up on Storm of Spoilers because it isn't like Game of Thrones. Occasionally we do a thought bubble special on Storm of Spoilers. This last one, both Neil and Joanna Robinson saw the movie. It's a good podcast. Go check it out. Storm of Spoilers thought bubble special.
It's a pretty strong movie that I think will have a very long half-life in sort of the way that movies used to spark on video. I think people will hip to it on streaming. It's a little formulaic, a little by the books, but is very strong for what it is. And Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, it'll be on DVD and Blu-ray and whatever before you know it. So keep an eye out. We have one last review from Sophia H. Tons, who says, a thank you note. I've been listening to this podcast for a while, but only now decided to write a review to say thank you. It's safe to say that over the past few weeks, Hollywood has been turned on its head with all the harassment stories that came to light. Something that has been present in the industry since its dawn. It's been truly satisfying to watch these disgusting wastes of space have their careers crash and burn, become radioactive and shunned in a matter of days, if not hours. But also, it has been tiresome, because with every abuser comes a victim, and countless accounts of what they had to suffer, what they had to endure, and what they lost. I dreaded opening my Twitter feed because I knew I didn't have to scroll down far to see a picture of Harvey Weinstein or Brett Ratner or Kevin Spacey or Louis C.K. or the other many, in parentheses, too many, TV/movie people accused, accompanied by an article telling a horrible story. Even going to see Thor Ragnarok, which was supposed to be pure joy sugar ride, then being surprised by Matt, father of four daughters, Damon, annoyed me. Don't get me wrong, I hope the conversation never ends. I hope we never stop calling people out on their bullshit, and that in the future, anyone who thinks of doing something like this will fear the consequences because they know they can get away with it, or they can't get away with it, rather. But I'm an avid movie fan, so I am an avid consumer of the industry and the journalism that comes with it, and it means a lot to me. So it's hard not to find all this disheartening, in parentheses, paired with the already evergreen frustration of the racism, misogyny, homophobia, etc. that already prevails in the industry, and to question if it is worth all the time I give to it. And I'm only a bystander. I can imagine what the people in this business, like yourselves, must have felt like. And then comes your podcast, that seems to be four friends, and sometimes Joanna, kindly letting us in on the conversation, talking about what you did or didn't like that week, how good was that performance, or what the soundtrack did. And I remembered that, hey, I like those things too, and that I am excited to watch Shape of Water or Call Me By Your Name. Hollywood is far from being fixed, but we all love the art, and it means a lot to me. So really, thank you for the reminder. Sorry this is so long, but you know, all the feels, XX. Sophia, H. Tons, thank you for such an eloquent and heartfelt review. It was, I think, very clearly helpful, as was Darby Axe, which I don't think I formally declared. I hope, I don't know, I think we try to be a reprieve from all of that stuff, but we did address it head on, and I think we might be about to do so again, and I hope that, I don't know, we find that balance.
We hope that you still like us by the end of the conversation.
No, I mean,
I like that review because I think that a lot of our mental energy of our job has been taken up by this stuff every week, and it kind of, and sometimes feels like there's not an Oscar race happening because everyone's just talking about these stories. But it's nice to be able to have a conversation and be like, okay, let's actually take the time to talk about Thor or something like that. And I'm glad it's not being seen as us trying to escape reality. I don't think any of us feel like we're doing that, but you know, there's still other stuff to talk about. So I'm glad other people are appreciating it.
There's certainly no escape from reality recently.
Ooh.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for leaving reviews. Please continue to do them. Whatever you write will be read live on the air. So thank you.
So speaking of getting away from the horrible men who run Hollywood and doing something else, we want to talk about Lady Bird, which is a movie that I'm certain David and I talked about plenty from Toronto, or in David's case, saw it at Telluride in early September. It's now out in theaters. It's not in Dave's town yet. It's not Denver, but it is expanding other places. Patches, you have now seen it.
It's making a lot of money. It's a big success so far.
It's a big indie theater in its limited number of theaters. It's a big financial success so far. You know, it's not beating Justice League.
I mean, it cracked the top 10 at the box office while being in 37 theaters, I think.
It is a massive hit already. Good for it.
And yeah, and indie hits are hard to come by. I feel like I have talked nonstop about this movie since I saw it at Toronto. So, Patches, why don't you start? After all of us telling you constantly that you had to see Lady Bird, did it live up to the expectations that we had?
Should we establish what this movie's about? I feel like maybe we...
I feel like you can do that in telling us, Whiffy.
All right.
Or you, go ahead and tell us what it's about.
I'm happy to. I mean, the premise here is very simple. Lady Bird is actually the main character. Christine Lady Bird McPherson, played by Saoirse Ronan. She is a high school senior. And her... As anyone who has survived the high school senior year, things are about to get crazy for her. There's a lot to figure out. And I felt, when I walked out of the movie, I'm like, life in senior year of high school is like a tilt-a-whirl, right? You're kind of like spiraling out of control in an individual way. You're having, you're thinking about the future, and you're having experiences that at the ending of something, in the beginning of something new. Your family is out of control, and you're having like sexual experiences and that sort of thing. And that's one thing.
Yeah, speak for yourself, buddy.
Heyo. And then life around you is like spinning in the other direction. You know, everything in the world could be changing, but you're still going through this transition time. So, and that's how I felt watching Lady Bird. She's just trying to, and she's trying to stay afloat throughout this whole crazy experience. Everything before it, she has her best friend. You know, they sit in the back of the class, they goof off, they hate Catholic school, and her mom drives her nuts. Her mom, played by Laurie Metcalf, wants everything in a perfect, you know, she wants the best for her daughter, which means cleaning up her room and folding her clothes and, you know, not spending a lot of money because they're on the lower end of the middle class. You know, they're trying to get by too. And her dad, played by, oh god,
Tracy Letts. Oh my god, get off my podcast.
What the hell?
How dare you?
2 seconds. I'm sorry.
No, that's 2 seconds too long for the mighty Tracy Letts.
The official Tracy Letts podcast.
Jeez,
he has lost his job in this movie, and their son is kind of a do nothing, stuck in working for a supermarket when he could be a programmer, and everyone is kind of wasting away around her. And Laurie Metcalf is trying to stay afloat in her own way, keep this family going. And Saoirse Ronan, being a 17-year-old, tells everyone to fuck off, just does her own thing, and wants to get by. She enlists for the school play. She has crushes on boys. She's applying to school. She's dreaming of getting out of Sacramento, California, the worst place in the world. But all she wants to do is be in New York City. So she's applying to schools that she totally can't afford and going behind her mom's back to get financial aid. And the whole world is being obliterated behind her, but she doesn't care because all she sees is freedom ahead. This is what being a high schooler, a self-obsessed high schooler, is all about. And this movie just captures every little nuanced moment of high schooldom and being a total asshole of a teenager. I don't think that Lady Bird is a very likable character. You know, she has her moments of kindness or hilarity.
Parental parlance, she is lovable, extremely, but not as likable.
Right, yeah.
In the way that your
right.
parents would always be like, I love you. You know, but,
I love
you,
yeah.
like
but
me?
I don't like
yeah.
you.
Confronts her mother over this exact notion. Yes. While trying on clothes when she doesn't look exactly that good, but her mom can't say so. But her mom can certainly give her shit, which is their relationship, right? Everything is not perfect enough. It's great that Christine will eventually graduate from college, but if she doesn't stand up straight and do it with a smile, then she's kind of failed her mother on some level. And this is the relationship that causes the most friction, and it drives Lady Bird through this whole year in the life. I was moved by it. I, you know, Katie, going into the movie, you had talked a lot about like the nostalgia. It takes place in 2002, 2003. That's exactly when I was this age and going through all these things. And I thought it would strike me a little more in like the nostalgia way, but it really doesn't. I don't feel like this movie's obsessed with high school in 2002. It's just obsessed with being in high school and the microcosm of that experience and the narcissism that comes with that and whatever, and trying to define freedom from the terms of being trapped in your hometown and only knowing that and thinking you know exactly what you want and how you want it. And I actually found that Laurie Metcalf's role as the mother trying to make sense of this girl, and perhaps it's because I'm about to be a father and have to raise a girl, and I was like, holy shit, holy shit, holy shit. that watching the mom struggle just made that I relate to that relationship. I don't relate to wanting to like escape my world so much, but I relate to not understanding parents and kind of lashing out in that way, feeling like I know what I'm up to and I know what I should be doing. And I found that their relationship more than individual performance, perhaps, to be these kind of like, you know, binary stars in this movie. Saoirse Ronan, Laurie Metcalf, the friction is just astounding. And I think Greta Gerwig has the language and the observations to really pull off the smallest moments and speak volumes about the bigger issues on the table.
I thought what you said about nostalgia is really interesting, because you're right that I have kind of like talked a lot about how it gets all these various details of this period exactly right. And I think you're right that it's not nostalgic in the way that we've come to expect. Like, it's not doing Stranger Things and like riffing on various things about pop culture in 2002. Like, you don't have to remember Ricky Martin. I guess even Ricky Martin.
Can we all agree that Lady Bird is better than Stranger Things, even though that they are slightly dissimilar projects? As we
just a little little dissimilar, yeah. But I think that's part of what is so powerful about it, is that it's so accurate and kind of clear-eyed about all of these feelings, and then it happens to be set in a time when I felt all of those feelings, and it kind of just mainlined everything that like I wasn't even intelligent enough to write in my journal at the time and put it onto a screen, which is like one of the many things that blew me away so much about it. And I still like find myself when people like, you know, my boss and Little Gold Man co-host Mike Hogan, who I saw it with, is, you know, 10 years older than me and was also really moved by it. I was like, oh, but so you get this, even though it's not about you in high school, which I for a while I thought no one else could get it. Now I just realize that's another strength of it, that it feels personal to everyone who manages to see it.
And the people she encounters feel very recognizable to me. Her friend who, you know, is going through her own tough times, but we don't get to see it because Christine Lady Bird is self-obsessed. She can't actually recognize her friend's problems, and only at the end do we get kind of the full scope of what her friend is going through. Her friend, played by this girl who's in Neighbors 2. Yeah, she's hysterical.
Jonah Hill's sister.
Not that we should define her by her brother's success, but she does happen to be Jonah Hill's sister, which is
always really?
An interesting point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
She's a joy. And she is a joy to watch.
Yeah. And she's a graduate of Wesleyan University, a fine educational establishment.
Oh, well, there you go.
the same Wesleyan University that produced Michael Bay. Please.
Yes, indeed.
And Katie Rich.
Yeah.
barely breaking even.
There's her, and then there's Lucas Hedges, who plays the boy that she first meets in theater. They're going to be in the play together, and she crushes hard on him. And he has his own revelations that are really, I mean, striking. I don't want to spoil that, what happens to the two of them, but their relationship flourishes, and I just think that it's so natural, the way that they fall head over heels in love for each other, what love means to them. And it's kind of, you know, they can profess their love while laying in a field and running around the suburbs. And it just,
this movie,
it's like, it's so limited in scope. You can tell someone that you love them, and it can only, you know, it only needs to extend 2 or 3 years through high school, but it means everything.
One of the reasons I think this movie is winning so many people over is because in addition to getting everything right, it moves like at the speed of a freight train. I don't know. Pick your analogy. But it feels like Greta Gerwig wrote a 400-page script and then only kept the 93 best beats or minutes, really. I mean, there are many beats within them. But every scene lasts just a few seconds, gets its point in, makes its mark. It tears through this school year or senior year. For me, I mean, I think that it really takes you by surprise and hits you with a wallop at the end, because all of its various emotions, its bittersweet feelings coalesce kind of suddenly, because there's been this momentum that hasn't really allowed you to take stock of everything and put it together. But when it gives you that moment's pause, it is very overwhelming. And for me, I think the thing that struck out more than anything else, in addition to all the things, the little details it gets right, particularly so far as class is concerned and one's relationship with where they come from, is the guilt that we feel towards our parents for not being adequately able to express how much we appreciate them and love them, and how, you know, it's a very normal teenage tendency to take that for granted, to spite them for it, and then sort of be eaten alive with all these other feelings you're having about leaving home and growing up and becoming your own person, that you were not able to show them the love that they deserve. And I think there's something that rang very true, at least to me, about
that. But also the reverse of that, too, the struggle that a parent would have to be really loving, but also disciplined in a way that sets kids on the right course.
That's
right?
Tracy. So the relationship between the parents is very important. I cannot let this review segment close without talking about Tracy Letts, who continues a theme this year, which is bad men in real life and beautiful dads on screen. You see with Michael Stuhlbarg in Call Me By Your Name, Tracy Letts here, Willem Dafoe in Florida Project, Ray Romano in Big Sick, and so on. But Tracy Letts is the good cop to Laurie Metcalf's bad cop. He's a little bit pathetic in his own way. Obviously, they both love their daughter, and they have very different ways of showing it. But I think that his way, what I think is interesting, just because he's sweeter to Lady Bird, is not privileged over how Laurie Metcalf treats her. It's a sort of a yin and yang to it, and they both have their downsides in how they communicate with her and what they mean to their daughter, and they both have their upsides. And I thought it was just such a beautifully realized portrait of how that dynamic can work.
Katie, can I ask you a question as we wrap up? Like, do you think that there is, I mean, obviously I identified a lot with this movie, but do you think there's something particularly, like, the female perspective or the female existence that Greta Gerwig gets right in this movie? Or do you think it's totally universal, this high school experience? I'm just curious. I mean, besides that, by the way, Christy Lady Bird sounds exactly like Greta Gerwig. It's crazy that Saoirse Ronan does, like Woody Allen style, does Greta Gerwig in this movie. It's crazy, but...
It's pretty good. I think the mother-daughter relationship is really, and again, like, I only have my own relationship with my mother. I don't have a daughter as of now. But the way that they get under each other's skin and kind of want the same things and then can also verge between, like, clawing at each other to, like, listening to an audiobook together in the car and weeping. Like, they are so entwined in each other's lives. And it's something that they both resent and appreciate at the same time. And, like... You know, with my mom when I was in high school, like, we could drive each other crazy in this really specific way that, like, no one else got on her nerves in the same way, and same for me. And I think there's something so complicated and hard to describe about that relationship that Lady Bird does really well. And I am sure there are men who had that similar relationships with their mom, but for me, that was what felt like it came from a female perspective. And also, just, we mentioned Lucas Hedges. There's also Timothy Chalamet, who's also in Call Me By Your Name, who is another boy who she has a crush on. I feel like it identifies cute high school boy types in this way. And I've been tweeting about this a lot. But I just, like, I don't think that people who weren't straight girls in high school would think about it in the same way. There's just a lot of little things that feel to me like Greta Gerwig, who is almost exactly my same age, so there's a lot of overlap there, sees things the way that a man or someone not our age.
No, you were a 2002 graduate as opposed to I know, a true 2003 graduate, and therefore, gender notwithstanding, you cannot possibly relate to this movie, and it is all about me. And I...
You grew up in New England and near New York City, where all the exciting things are. I grew up in some backwater far away, way smaller than Sacramento, and wanted to move to New England where all the interesting things were and where people read books.
And you did it.
Which is true.
Interesting in quotes.
The best movie in the world, and everyone should go see it. Thoughts?
I have two, like, hyper-specific, spoiler questions that people can jump ahead from, or we can just cut the segment entirely, but...
I'm sorry. I really want... We were rapping. Yeah,
I really want to ask them. The first one is about Stephen Henderson, who appears in this film as the drama coach, and who is totally...
Well, no, he's the drama teacher, eventually the drama coach.
True. Sorry, I should draw a distinction. The drama coach is hysterical, by the way. That is a great
bit. Funny.
He's the drama teacher, and I find Stephen Henderson, like, completely watchable in everything. He was so good in Fences last year, and I just...
Yeah.
He's this depth of personality, and, you know, you just want to watch the world through his eyes. He goes through something. I think his child has died, and they're doing like a crying exercise, and it breaks him up, right? And
I think that's the implication, is that he's had a loss like before the movie.
But then he actually sees Laurie Metcalf, who plays a psychiatric nurse in the film, and like for counseling or something. I was curious what you guys made of that. I must have flinched or something during that bit, and I couldn't.
I think it's just a blind spot for Lady Bird. It's another thing that she is sort of uninterested in because it's not happening to her. Everybody is hurting. Everybody has feelings. It's very, very vague in a movie that is seldom vague. But it seems to me that he has some sort of depression, whatever the cause of it. If it's chemical or exacerbated by something that happened to him, I don't know. But it's like one of those little details in your life that you can that are very peripheral to your own experience that I think you just sort of can easily phase out. And this, it seems like Greta Gerwig just chose this particular one to give some life beyond what Lady Bird could see of it, as sort of representative of all the things that she was not interested in herself.
Well, it just seems like such great detailing, and I find that the stitching is all over this movie. I really like little bits like that. Then my second question to you is about Beanie Feldstein's character, Julie, who has her mom is dating this guy who we do actually see at one point early on in the film. She gives him lunch, and this guy he's in everything. He's like a TV actor, and he was on The Office for a while, and he's just a recognizable character actor guy. And he doesn't really come back, but she mentions him all the time. And I kind of got the impression that he was, like, creeping on her. But we never see that. And the relationships are so weird. She also has a thing for her teacher that never comes to pass because she's lusting after him and he has nothing to do with that, of course. Which I found
so,
very realistic.
So awkward.
Yeah, it's super awkward. But then the whole thing with her dad, just it was so creepy and pronounced that I
it is not pronounced.
Maybe I was writing fan fiction.
Yeah, it didn't.
That
it didn't
just it could be creepy, but it is not pronounced.
I don't know. He gets a close up and he never comes back. I just thought that was really weird. And she's kind of like,
I saw it in a pre Roy Moore era, so maybe it's just not.
Yeah,
where
maybe
my head
that's
was.
Where my head is. I don't know.
I think the movie gives you the wiggle room to read whatever you want into it, which is sort of the opposite of it being pronounced. But I think, you know, it is true that he has a little bit of a presence there. My takeaway of it, because I'm not a sick pervert like Matt Badges, is that he was just trying to like insinuate himself into her mom's life and like be available to her. It's entirely possible that your read on it could be true. But I think, again, it's just one of those details where, like, when you think back on your own childhood, you're like, or your own teenage years, you're like, huh, that was weird. I never really gave it much thought at the time. And then maybe you're sitting there when you're 33 years old and saying, I bet it's because he was a pedophile. I don't know.
That's what I'm thinking. I could totally buy that as an explanation, that there's all these just passing moments, other people's lives brushing up against Lady Bird. I love that about the movie. It just feels very, as you said, it feels like there's an expanse behind the story we get to see. It's the dream.
I don't know if we really need a transition between Lady Bird and Alias Grace, our next topic, but I'm just going to do it anyway. And Lady Bird, you have a real Irish accent, a real Irish actress hiding her accent to be American. And then Alias Grace, you have a Canadian actress adopting an Irish one. It's a fascinating fact. Mostly, other than the fact that there are female filmmakers behind both, there's basically nothing in common between Lady Bird and Alias Grace. Alias Grace is a 6-part miniseries that debuted on Netflix, I think, 2 weeks ago. It was written entirely by Sarah Polley, directed entirely by Mary Herron, adapted from a Margaret Atwood novel, and starring Sarah Gadon. So it's got every powerful Canadian woman who exists, basically, except for Joni Mitchell. And I watched the whole thing. Patches, you've watched the whole thing. Dave, you've watched most of it. This show, I think I was telling one of you guys that I kind of watched it at first. It didn't feel like it was for me. It was too much of a heavy period piece, but it's really stuck with me. And I'm curious if it's getting under your skin in the same way.
I mean, I had the same sort of, I guess, I mainlined the first 4 episodes so I could talk about it with some sort of legitimacy. And I had the same problem over the first 2 episodes where it was too heavily period piece and I didn't really understand what the miniseries was trying to accomplish as a whole. I mean, I get that, you know, it's about the plight of, you know, the patriarchy holding women down around this, like, Canadian revolution. But it wasn't until, like, the episode 3 or episode 4 that I sort of shifted my perspective from historical drama just a straight up horror movie. And that really helped me, I think, meet it halfway, so that the dread that I was feeling constantly felt more in line with the narrative and I guess less like a lecture, like a historical lecture. So it's like, I'm going to go deeper into that. There's a lot of like movies about like the slave narrative, I think, that were made and shown to us in elementary and middle school that were supposed to be people's, you know, like first realization that these things were horrible, that these things were done in like American history. But as you grow up watching those things, you start to pick out the unartfully done ones as sort of like having a lecturing tone. Like, yeah, the villains don't have nuance. They're like arch villains and things, you know, I guess slavery is a bad example to use to say things are really black and white. As like a horror narrative, not only is the fact that, you know, this movie doesn't bring up the fact that it's based on a novel, which is based on true events, but it allows, I think, part of what the novel occurs or the novel accomplishes by switching between the first person and the third person perspective or switching narrators. It does by sort of quick cutting scenes that you're going to see later. or scenes in different contexts or different audio mix of scenes together in a montage that's more like a horror movie narrative. So I think by the end of it, I don't know how it ends, and I don't know if we get like a resolution to the mystery that's set up at the beginning of it, but I think it's going to be more about like the tonal journey like an Italian horror film would be than, say, this whodunit with feminism lectures tacked on to, which I think is what I mistook it for in the beginning, because I think The Handmaid's Tale sort of felt like that to me, but then also had like the sin of being too boring at the beginning to like keep me hooked in. But I kind of feel like those some of those issues blown to like the arch of a alternate future, I think are less impactful than they are here in Alias Grace, where they're more massaged out through good narrative of real historical fact.
I want to jump in because then I want to hear Katie talk, because I've actually only seen the first two episodes, dubbed the boring episodes by both of you, I believe. and I should say that while I did find it really murky and a little difficult to latch on to exactly what was supposed to be propelling this narrative, I have to say, Mary Harron is a hell of a director. Like, I just love the frames that she's able to cook up, and using the period setting and using the kind of flashback drama that is built into kind of like the psychiatric conversations that are happening at the heart of this thing. I just, it's kind of a whirlwind experience, and it's like her other work. You know, I don't think she's made a movie in quite a while, and I kind of had to go grasping for memories of her past work. But I feel like as I was going back to like American Psycho or something, or I Shot Andy Warhol.
Was that her last movie?
No, she made
The Moth Diaries in like 2011, which was barely released.
Yeah, she's done a few.
But Sarah Gadon was in that, which is where that relationship.
And she's done some television.
Can I ask a quick question to someone who is desperate to watch this but has not had a chance yet? How good is Sarah Gadon in it, and why is Sarah Gadon not a major movie star yet?
She is insanely good in this show. Patches, I don't know if you feel like you watched enough of it, but she's doing this like kind of like Still Waters Run Deep thing, where she's this Irish woman who is incredibly poor and basically has no power in life. And then you see her in these interview scenes with this doctor where she's got a little bit more power. She's been accused of murdering the people she was working for. And she's basically just slipping between different faces that she puts on in public and then kind of her private narrative, and then she looks at the camera, and there's like 10 different performances inside this role, and she's amazing.
Yeah, her role is basically like, I'm going to put the camera 2 inches away from your face and your giant eyes, and you have to be able to do like 10 characters and slip back and forth between them at any given time. It's pretty exhilarating. But wait, Katie, so I want to just ask you kind of to what Dave was talking about, you know, the narrative as a whole. Like, if you're like me and hitting the first two episodes, you're like, I'm kind of lost, or I just want to know, you know, I love what they're doing with the direction and that sort of thing, but what gets people across the finish line? What, you know, Dave made it to the meat, but do you find in the macro sense that it's like, you know, there's something to get people to the end here? That
I mean, it's weird because it's a strange time to be watching it, because what the show is really about, it's about this murder mystery, this, you know, woman was accused of murdering these people, and did she really do it, et cetera. But it's kind of about the patriarchy and about the shit that women have had to put up with for all of history. And it's looking back at this period of time that's been really idealized. And I talked to Sarah Polley about this, and she mentioned that she was on this show, Road to Avonlea, when she was a kid, which she became kind of famous for. And it's all about, like, you know, girls in the 1800s in frilly white dresses. And this show is about the maids who iron those dresses and have to bleach them, and like the incredible backbreaking labor it took to maintain that society. And the more you look at it, the more just infuriated you become at what these people had to go through and how their lives were completely upended by men or just a general society that didn't consider them worth it. So it's not cathartic in that way, because we still live in a patriarchy, but it's just a really kind of like, if you're in the mood to kind of see the seedy side of the world picked up and watch all the roaches running around underneath, like this kind of continues that impulse of what's happening right now. And then you have the performances in the middle of it. You have Sarah Gadon, you've got Anna Paquin shows up as the woman she's accused of killing. Zachary Levi is in kind of a strange role, but actually really good in it.
Or Ragnarok's Zachary Levi.
Thor Ragnarok really, that's where he went after he left Asgard. So it's got a lot of like the, I think the production elements kind of start to feel like you're in this consistent world. And then I don't know, like, I became really interested to watch like how angry it was going to become, like how focused it was going to be on all of these injustices in a kind of the way that The Handmaid's Tale is, but a really a lot more subtler. And a lot more like within the genre of the historical drama, and then like Dave was saying, horror rather than being sci-fi. And then, like I was saying, like I was watching it, and you know, maybe thought it wasn't for me. And I just, there are just moments that I can't stop thinking about weeks later.
It does have that thing where it's like the ambiguous moments end up being the ones that are the most terrifying, because there's an underlying feeling of dread throughout the whole thing. Like when Anna Paquin's characters finally introduced, like she's wants to give the main Grace a new job, and there's a, like already another character there, it's like, don't do it, this is like all bad news. And like she has a really close relationship with her friend Mary, and her friend Mary basically like tells her off of a whole bunch of different things that end up seeing like inescapable like things of that society like builds in. So the fact that you know that all of this is coming, either through the narrative or just through realizing that that's the theme of this, like, I don't know, arch narrative. It's really, there's like a constant terror. And then when the episode I got to, there's suddenly like a dream sequence, which is why pulled up like Italian horror references, is because it's like got some biblical stuff mashed up in it, 'cause she's a Protestant and she's like sort of self-justifying, but it's also what the whole series is about. So It really elevates beyond, I think, the first few episodes, which are setting you up for it to get crazier and crazier.
Although there is, in the first episode, or maybe the second one, there's this really stunning sequence where they're in the hold of the ship that took her and her family over to Canada. And like, it was just kind of this long panning shot of people falling out of beds and vomiting and kind of the misery that was going on there. I thought that was really striking and kind of an early example of where they were going to go with this.
Oh yeah. Well, they pull out of it and it's like framed so that like all the lights coming through the holds through the ladder area, and there's occasionally like water spilling down, and then she sort of like echoes that framing when they're walking into Ontario or wherever they're going for the first time.
Toronto.
And like both times, Toronto, sorry, I should have obviously known that. And like both times they're just like walking on filth, like wherever,
yeah,
everywhere these
oh,
people
yeah.
go, it's just like covered in filth, and they turn around and make it clean for everybody else.
To be fair, yeah, Toronto is in Ontario.
Yes. I feel like we haven't done, you know, for all of the ways that we're reconsidering the Civil War here, there just hasn't been a lot of reconsidering history from a woman's perspective in this way. And there are, and these are the women who made these societies possible, and to see it visualized and made this expensively and with this much talent involved, it really is not something you've seen before.
Yeah, not to disparage what I'm about to say, but this is not like Little Women or Anne of Green Gables,
no.
or like,
no, no,
I
yeah.
feel like
which is
women,
good. I don't like those things.
Women are forced into these certain types of historical dramas, but this is not that. And you know, because David Cronenberg shows up to make sure everything is just fucked.
Yeah. David Cronenberg has a very small part, but it kind of felt like they had to have him in there just to like get the Canadian tax credit or whatever. And I will say for anyone, the final episode, there's not a twist in it exactly, but the like one of the last scenes is like jaw-droppingly great. So if you ever feel yourself lagging, hang in there for that.
Hang into the end if you feel yourself lagging, says Katie.
I'm telling you, like, I got to that part and it was really like, oh wow, I've been underestimating this whole time.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips, and there's no tenderness like before in your fingers. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby, baby, I know it. You lost that love and feeling. Oh, that
Men are perfect and have never done anything wrong. Give me one example of how that isn't true.
Guys, it's been a crazy, I guess it's been more than a month now. And it feels like it's not going to stop for a long time. Like, we all have our personal list of the next person who's going to get outed for having done horrible things to other people. But anyway, as we record this, the latest most high profile one, unless something's happened in the last hour on Twitter, was Louis C.K., who had a New York Times expose published about him last Thursday in a really fairly similar process to Harvey Weinstein, though I think we can all agree his crimes were not nearly as dramatic or heinous or extensive that we know of so far. Anyway, his movie, I had already received an award screener for it, and it was pulled from release, which is totally nuts. And I was talking about this on Friday, I think, and how I now have a copy of his movie that I have basically no desire to watch. And as someone who in the past has kind of felt pretty comfortable, you know, separating the art from the artist, and we've definitely talked about this on the show before, where you can think what Roman Polanski did was bad, but still enjoy Chinatown. I've felt that ability kind of slipping away from me. Like, I don't think that I could watch Chinatown right now, or Manhattan, or I Love You, Daddy, or I mean, anything Burt Ratner made, but fuck that guy.
You don't think enough time has passed for I Love You, Daddy to be considered in a different context.
To be considered canon. Yeah, you know, it was made in a different time. I feel like there's this personal revulsion that I feel that I didn't used to. And I think the thing that maybe surprised Dave and Patches when I mentioned this is that if I were teaching a film class right now, I wouldn't include Chinatown. Like, I would mention it and, like, talk about its existence, but just find other 70s movies to program. And I feel like that's fine. I feel like that's not demanding this movie be stricken from the record, but just kind of like adhering to my personal sense of what deserves to be considered history and celebrated. And I don't know. Well, I was kind of surprised by this. I feel like that's a really radical position. That would have been a radical position for me a couple months ago, and now that's happening.
To be fair, yeah. I Love You, Daddy is not part of the film school canon. Never will be. But
No, I don't think anyone
more comparable is his work on Louis, you know, or his stand-up special. Or the things that have actually made an impact over the years. That's an equivalent here. And to many,
yeah,
Louis
definitely.
is as influential as those things, as many people have mentioned in their analysis of the situation. Louis kicked off a string of these kind of like docu-comedies about, you know, memoirist comedies, and he started a revolution on television. To not mention Louis, the television show's place in television canon might be glossing over fact.
But that's for
I don't think you can ever not talk about Louis when talking about it, but do you need to watch it?
Well, I think the first time, so
it's like microfilm in the future. You can go to a library and watch part of it if you really want. I think it's archival material in some way. I was watching Noelle Wells her directorial feature debut today, Mr. Roosevelt, and that's probably a film just because of its genre, its rhythms and whatnot, feels like it was deeply influenced by Louis. And if it wasn't, then it was somehow made possible by the kind of content that he made palatable and made people want to make and finance. But now we have a movie like Mr. Roosevelt, and so we don't necessarily need to watch Louis stuff. But I think, you know, Katie, to your point, it's, you know, impossible to separate the art from the artist on some level, and also impossible not to, in a way. Like, it goes both ways. I mean, like, you can't watch... I mean, you'll never be able to watch Louis without being able to... Not that you will necessarily choose to watch I Love You, Daddy or Louis, but you wouldn't be able to watch either of those things without projecting your own... what you know about him now. I mean, they'd be fundamentally different programs and films now that you know these things about him and now that he's had his day in the court of public opinion, because our justice system has made it impossible for women to feel comfortable to come forward, to adequately process these cases so that we don't have a way of actually, like, penalizing men and putting them back into society. So it's left to us to just, judge them in public. You know, at the same time, 100 years from now, somebody could find an episode of Louis and would watch it without all this baggage, and it would be its own thing. I think that, like, it's not really a choice. When people talk about the choice, I guess that's what I mean to say. When it comes down to the to people talking about separating the art from the artist, I don't think that it's a choice that we have so much as it's it's just a symptom of whatever context we have when we approach it. I don't think it's like a choice that you can make to put on Chinatown, for example, and say, for the next 2 hours, I'm simply not going to think about Roman Polanski and anything about who he is or what he did and how it might color this movie. I mean, it is a part of your scheme of knowledge. It's a part of the galaxy of what you know.
Although, I mean, in the case of something like Chinatown, I guess Polanski appears in the movie, but it doesn't seem far-fetched to me, being able to watch a movie like that and not think about those things.
Although Pinetown is also, spoiler alert, about an inappropriate relationship that a woman has put through that traumatizes her.
That's true. Yeah. Maybe it's a little more difficult than I thought it would be. But I guess what I'm saying is in some of these classic film instances where you're not seeing the person, you're getting lost in theory in a compelling narrative that you wouldn't think about these things necessarily, that they do feel divorced because they just don't brush up against these accusations in any way.
But I also I don't want to be someone who is saying that who's really rushing to say like, no, people have to see this film. There's value to it, because I think that it's the value of doing what we can to fight against this sort of systemic oppression is endlessly more valuable than anything. Using him as part of the ammunition in our war against this sort of violence is an abuse is more valuable than anything that he's created in his artwork and certainly in this film. But it is interesting to think of this movie in the terms of the protagonist being, or the guy who made the film rather, being guilty of a lot of the things that the protagonist expresses and wrestles with, a lot of the having a lot of the impulses and the shame that he has discussed. I mean, it's another level of autobiography to it. And I think it changes the movie from being something exploratory to something confessional. And I'm not saying that that is in and of itself any reason to go and seek out this movie, or that it should be, that people should be exposed to it. But, you know, talking about separating the art from the artist, I think that it's something that fundamentally changes the work and makes it more confessional, and seeing there is value in the abstract, if not in this particular example, of seeing someone wrestle with their own shame on or in art of any kind. And I think that that is something that is likely to be lost, although how much of a loss that is to us as a whole is obviously up for debate and probably pretty marginal. But it's worth discussing. But when we talk about separating the art from the artist in such moral terms, and I've just been stuck these last couple of weeks of thinking how it's not really a choice that we have, that we probably can't really do that, and that attempts to do so are probably disingenuous, and that it's just not really up to us.
I think what you're saying about how art can be really interesting in terms of someone grappling with shame is objectively true. But I think maybe before I would have been kind of susceptible to the argument being like, yeah, but it's a historical document. It's like part of a thing that you need to recognize. And I think I'm finding myself really skeptical of a notion of a canon at all. And the idea that we're kind of tearing down these structures that have made this possible in Hollywood. And some of those structures are saying, these are the great movies. These are the great filmmakers. And I kind of don't want to follow that anymore. Like, I don't want to watch Roman Polanski movies at all, because I just don't want to.
Right.
Like, there's too many movies out there for me to see. I could go see Professor Mercer and the Wonder Women instead, or whatever else is out there. I feel like the business that has been built has been made to prop up these men, allow them to continue to do what they wanted to do. And, many of them are extremely talented and, deserve recognition for it. But I think I can choose to not have to work within that structure, at least for now. And I feel okay about that. And I wouldn't have before.
I think that's beautifully said and totally true. And I think there are enough options out there. I mean, it's hard to go back. Unfortunately, a lot of the films that would have been part of that sort of alternative canon were not made for these same reasons, because the women just weren't allowed into the system back in the day. And so this, to a certain extent, those are the films that we have, but it's a lot easier to think about where we are now and recent history, and most of all going forward, to make sure that we do provide future generations with that alternate canon, so they're not stuck in the same position that we are.
Yeah, like everyone can just go watch Daughters of the Dust instead, which clearly much. I have no idea how available it is. So I shouldn't say
increasingly
that.
So.
But anyway,
I mean,
yeah, like there's just so much to choose from that you don't get caught up in all of this.
Well, we hope. I mean,
oh yeah, Jesus.
The
okay.
truth is,
yeah, hopefully,
it's the problem is vast, and the things that you would cling to for solace could potentially be poisoned by this eventually. So it seems a little.
Is that true? I mean, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but like how many women are guilty of things that the kind of things that we're talking about? I mean, I think
I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that men work on a lot of things.
Sure, but Katie's talking about, you know, finding like a female fronted canon, and you know, maybe not exclusively female, but certainly trending in that direction. I was reading an article today about how they were hypothesizing how like the Breitbart medias of the world could use the Democrats, the liberal or the right thinking person's philosophy of believing women against them in a really almost unfathomably cynical way, where like on the eve of the election in 2020, they could fabricate accusations of sexual assault against whatever the Democratic candidate is, because they know that it would be contradictory to say for all of the liberals who are supporting this person that we shouldn't not believe this woman. And that is obviously
Whoa,
sort of,
I mean, that's some like InfoWarsing up in this joint.
Oh yeah. Listen. That's exactly what they want, because for that kind of thinking to infect the real world is toxic, because that is the kind of thinking that I think some people could use to, it would slowly seep into the day to day, not just in music. Well, I'm going to get there in a second, which is to say, in terms of Katie's idea of the canon, my solution to that, what the crazy hypothetical proposed by that article was, to have another female candidate, because it would be a lot harder to pin that sort of story on her. I mean, there are any number of reasons why you should have a female candidate, not just protection against this one insane idea. But I think to what Katie's talking about, like you can have, there is a certain amount of faith and safety in placing your trust in these, movies that are made by women. I think a lot of my heroes are women, a lot of the artists that I respect, and I don't live in fear that we're going to learn stories about Bjork, you know, horribly abusing people.
That wasn't my suggestion.
We don't have this sort of, you know, it's like in reverse racism. It doesn't exist, this sort of opposite sexism. It's a contradiction in terms. And so there is safety there. I'm not saying
that's not what I was suggesting at all.
I've just been thinking a lot about like a more almost purely female canon and how like much of a relief it could be. Anyway.
So Patches, what were you trying to get at?
Well, let me get a word in here and I'll try and explain myself. I guess what I'm saying is, Katie, you're describing the kind of like flushing of many, many years of movies that have, you know, in an industry that's been dominated by men, but doesn't that feel like, yeah, a little extravagant, even in these kind of dire times, that yes, we want, if you want to strike Polanski movies and Woody Allen films, there are a lot of other options, but to say that the like pillars of a certain canon are coming down, that you don't need these movies. I mean, a lot of people invested time who are not evil presences. Everything being flushed and you're turning away from everything and painting in this broad stroke?
I have concerns about that too, because I think we're going to get to a point where we're going to, you know, go back and look at old Hollywood and being like, oh, well, Jack Warner was involved in this movie and he was a creep, so don't watch anything made by Warner Brothers for 30 years. I think that's impossible and ludicrous. I'm more talking about just kind of like a personal experience of like what I'm seeking out, what I want to look into, like what I want to value in history, and then kind of expanding that to some hypothetical class that I'm teaching that I'm not teaching. Just the idea that you can kind of build a canon of other things and be aware of these movies and watch Manhattan. And, you know, if you want to understand comedy, you kind of have to be familiar with Woody Allen in the 70s. But just to kind of recognize that that doesn't have to be all that it is, and that you can kind of prop up other things. I mean, I've been doing this in books. Like, I've just been kind of like, when I choose to read fiction, I'm choosing books by women because I'm kind of tired of reading books by men. And I think it's okay to indulge that. It's not even indulging. I think it's okay to follow that impulse after what's happening with all of this in a way that I didn't
sure.
used to. And that's,
I guess,
kind of the thing that I'm intrigued
by. It's the building of canon that doesn't really make sense to me. It's just like, why are we obsessed with the pillars of moviedom? Why do we need, can't we just invest in the movies we care about? And if some feel defiled, then we let them fall away. I mean, it's exactly what you're
saying. That's a little naive. It's not how it works. I mean, I think that there, it's especially with an art form so young where people still, and I know a lot of these people have the delusion that you can actually master the medium as a whole. And essentially by the time you die, see everything worth seeing that has ever been made to it, which is a phenomenon you don't see in literature and in music and other things like that. And I think it does seem impossible, and life is short. But, you know, there are certainly people out there giving it their best shot. And there is, I certainly understand that impulse where you feel like you could master it enough, at least in a way. And I think having a history that leans a little bit harder on a canon is a lot more, it's a lot harder to move away from in a medium as young as film as it would be in any other sense, which is not to say that the canon of Western literature is something that is particularly flexible. I mean, that is as difficult to penetrate as anything else, and is also in dire need of changing.
Well, that's another example. I mean, honestly, it kind of goes back to Alias Grace, like the idea of telling history from the perspective of people who hadn't done it. Like, give me a Western literature course that only has women and people of color in it, and I think you could have an entire semester's worth of that. And, you know, obviously you need to acknowledge that The Great Gatsby exists, but have a completely different perspective on the world. You live in the world that was built by the white men. If you go back and look at the films that were made from another perspective, I think you gain a lot and maybe don't lose as much as we think.
Dave?
I mean, everybody has good points, but I think that the truth is somewhere more in the middle, because it's not that we're suddenly going to have a new canon. It's that our film classes are going to have to incorporate a system of structural harassment if we're going to pay attention. I had to, like, figure out the definition of minstrelly theater by myself, because it was excluded from all my theater classes because it's offensive. And it is offensive, but it existed, and it exists as a theatrical art form. We just saved that in a little library for adults only, which is fine, but it's not film. That was a specific part of theater. I think, like, it's amazing to me that the Louis C.K. conversation is, like, blossoming more, because I had, like, all the Louis C.K. problems with Bill Cosby, but, like, five times as big. Where, like, I loved, like, fatherhood and, you know, watched The Cosby Show and was definitely more emotionally invested in both those pieces of art when they were, like, when I was younger, and therefore it has, like, a nostalgia thing, and I feel close to them, and so that sort of felt like a weird comedian/media portrayal, and I just had to, like, cut it all out, because now if I do go back to those things, if I go back to the Spanish fly jokes, there's something different. And so my history of it has changed, but it's only in adding more context. I don't know if I want anything to fall away. I don't know if I'm as okay with that adults-only corner of the library when it comes to art. But I think that's a safe place to start. I think all of our film history classes just have to be amended to things. And maybe that means opting out of things. I think that Katie's decision on a personal basis, and as somebody who consumes a bunch of media, is great. You're the kind of person I want forming a new canon and telling me what to watch.
And Katie,
but in terms of, like, the education and the... Well, in terms of the education and the history of it, I think it's the same thing we kind of were talking about back when we did our Weinstein segment, which is, like, the history of how we talk about all these things need to change. I don't know if we have to part and parcel throw out entire movies that's based on how everybody's feeling, but it's just that you don't necessarily tear down the monuments if you could just change the plaque.
But yeah, and I think, you know, what Katie said about her, the fact that she's not teaching a class, I don't think is entirely true. I mean, she's raising a child. I mean, I think you are going to be shaping somebody's worldview, and what you determine to be worth teaching is going to be of, you know, great importance to Charlie. And of course, he will rebel against whatever it is and go seek out the opposite of what you tell him to see. But,
definitely,
you know, there'll be a little bit of both. But I think you personally making the decision that Chinatown is not, you can find a replacement for Chinatown. You can find another movie that, you know, was made by a woman, or another movie that was less personally troublesome to you, and you can find value in that because there are
I guess that's what
there.
I was getting at before. I mean, David, you mentioned I was being naive about not having a canon, but it's really about not accepting any canon and not believing in one and shaping your own and having the conversations that you mm-hmm. want to have and putting everything in the context that it belongs in. I mean, I guess you could watch K-Pax
again.
Well,
but I know,
again,
how do you live with, like, auteurship, 1970s New Hollywood filmmakers without happening across a ton of these people that are going to have problematic histories?
Right, but,
oh,
but
yeah,
that's,
I mean, you're definitely,
but the historical
you're not
context,
that they don't exist. Right.
The historical context is now, like, Hollywood was driven by men, and, like, the opportunities came to these people, and we know now that they abused this power, and this is how New Hollywood was forged. There's a new definition
of
this history.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's a new history now, and that's has to be focused on as much as forming a new canon is, because they're a parallel process.
Yeah, like, I we think can't go, basically, like, we need a people's history of the United States, but for Hollywood, and just have the version of the story that's been happening the whole time, but, you know, though not the one that's written by the white men who've gotten to control the narrative the whole time. And they'll still have made the films. And if you're making a movie, if you're teaching a class about the 70s and you don't show Jaws, you're probably not doing it right. But I think you can shift the focus.
I don't know. That shark touched a lot of people without asking.
Yeah,
That shark did not ask for consent.
Oh, God. I wanted to just be like, hey, leave Jaws out of this. And then I remembered... Richard Dreyfuss, and I think, you know, just speaks to Katie's point, or whoever was making the point about how a lot of these films are going to be touched in some way, which goes back to my long rambling point, which is why that if you do your best to stick to films made by women, you know, and I'm not being a fundamentalist or absolutist about that and saying, like, I'm not going to watch any more films made by men, because we know that's not true, but there is, whenever I see, like, last year, one of our colleagues only watched films made by women for an entire year. And whenever I think about what that would do to somebody's perception of film, especially through the lens of what we're seeing right now, I just think about how, I don't know, how there are worse ideas in the world.
I think we're in a really good place right now where everybody's right. I agree with everybody.
I mean, I think with this is maybe a separate topic for another day, but the Richard Dreyfuss example just makes me think, I feel like everyone needs to have their point where they decide if something is not worth it. Like, at this point, I don't feel like Jaws is something I can't watch again for me. Maybe for someone else it's different. I feel like, I mean, I wouldn't want to watch American Beauty for reasons, but Kevin Spacey's accusations don't really have anything to do with that for me, I don't think. Anyway,
but isn't being empowered,
I think it's a personal decision for everyone.
Isn't you particularly feeling empowered to make that personal decision rather than feeling like you are duty bound to watch something because it's part of the canon, exactly the sort of evolution that the industry needs as a whole?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the thing. That's where, like, so I think previously I thought, like, if you felt like, you know, it's not about trigger warning so much, but just being like, I don't need to support this person with my money. And I think before I would have said, like, no, but it's important filmmaking. And now it feels like, no, you're empowered to push everyone in a different direction.
Because I shirk in general in life, not just in terms of these sexual assault accusations. I shirk against people wholesale saying you can't do this, you should do that, and so on. That sort of fundamentalism just is always felt... I don't know, limiting to me. But I hear someone like you say, you know, I'm going to set my own limits for what I am comfortable endorsing and, you know, being a part of and contributing my time to, sometimes my money to, versus where I need to draw the line. And I think that when we get to the point where every consumer, and I don't know, I'm feeling like this sounds patronizing, I think, you know, I don't know, we all need to work on this, but I think that, like, when we have, like, the next generations of people who are all not only comfortable drawing their own line in the sands, but actively doing so because they have this complete information and are interested and believe it's possible in creating a new canon, then we will be freed from the one that we have now, and people will just personally be able to take the movies they want with them.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I am on Twitter @MrPatches, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes. You can comment on episodes. We had some great comments last week about German censorship rule. We got school. If you want to go learn about that, you should. I guess it's not censorship. That was the first slap on the wrist. I shouldn't call it that. Anyway, go read it on fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook, at Fighting in the War Room Facebook, the most famous site started by the person Jordan Hoffman, sometime guest on the show, believes in his heart will be the next president of the United States.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, D-A-7-E. That's also my Twitter handle. You could find some of my work pinned to the top there at Thrillist.com. And then also you could find me on the Star Wars Spoilers podcast. This week we're talking about Justice League, because we're all seeing Justice League. And if you've been following Star Wars Spoilers, you know each week we've been checking up with this movie we were pretty sure was not a movie until last week. So, yeah, that'll be something for sure.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com. I'm also on the podcast, Little Men, talking more about award season and Lady Bird and all that stuff. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And we're all on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R. You can talk to us about a lot of things and answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Justice League, what's the best movie finished by another director?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
I can see inside you the sickness is rising. Don't try to deny what you feel.
Will you give it to me?
It seems that all that was good has died and is decaying.